always do, start with a story. This time, I would like you to think, we're going to do some of the how-tos of finding stories and researching, not researching as much, that takes too much time, finding stories learning a story and telling a story and uses, when you could use this type of story or any type of story. So as you listen to this one, which happens to be a family story, I want you to think of, you know, how would you learn a story like that? Maybe you don't ever want to learn a story like that because you need to choose stories that you love. And if you don't love this kind of story, don't try to do it. So look at some of that. Look at where the information might have come from. Look at how you could add things for filling in some of the cracks or something if there were. And then we'll go from there. My mother, Emma Louise de Slover Hiker, was born on August the 17th, 1915. Now, she was the fourth child and first girl out of a family that ended up with 9 living children. It's important for you to remember the order of these children for this story. There were 3 boys, then there was my mother. There were 3 more boys, and then there was her only sister when my mother was 12 years old. At the very end was my, what I call my baby uncle. He's only about 4 years older than I am. Well, when my mother was born, it wasn't too much of a problem to dress her because she had 3 brothers who were older than her. And until you were 2 or 3 or so years old, boys and girls alike all wore the same thing. You know, a diaper, a long dress in the wintertime, socks, and some little black shoes if you needed the shoes. But in the summertime, they only wore coveralls or a diaper, actually, until they got older. Just a diaper. But that was still no problem. Boys and girls were the same, and so my mother didn't have to worry about anything. But then, when she got to be about 3, 4, somewhere in there, what was passed down from Prosper to Cyril to Alphonse and then to my mother, Emma, boys and girls were usually different. But not in my mother's family. Because the other thing you have to know is that my mother's family was very poor. My grandfather came from Belgium when he was 19. My grandmother had come when she was 4. They met in a sugar beet camp where many, many Belgians were working. They never got a whole lot of money. So you know what happens when you don't have much money. You try to recycle, you try to save, you try to share. You don't buy a whole lot of new stuff unless it's really necessary. Well, as I said, when you got to be about 3 or 4 years old, boys and girls got separated. The boys wore coveralls, bib overalls, and in the winter they wore flannel shirts. In the summertime, they didn't wear any shirt, just the coveralls. Now, on their feet, they wore some knit stockings. My grandmother knit the stockings. She wasn't a very good knitter. I mean, she had lumps and bumps all over the place in those stockings, and sometimes trying to find out where the heel was a little difficult. But it wasn't too bad when my mother got them, because by that time, after 3 boys had worn them, they had gotten a little smoothed out, so it wasn't quite as difficult. But oh, those shoes. I mean, she wore her brother's shoes, and they were high-button leather tie shoes. Oh, did she hate those shoes. She didn't wear a dress except one time that I know of when she was that age, and I know it because I've got the picture. This is a picture of a little girl standing there. You could see her freckles, so you knew there was red hair up here. Don't know what color the dress was, but my mother tells me it was red. It seems that one day, when she was about 4 years old, her Aunt Josephine came to the house and wanted to take my mother to town. Now, they lived out in the woods, and town was a real exciting place. But even more important, she wanted to take just my mother alone. Now, by this time, there were, I don't know, 5 or 6 kids, 1 girl. She never got to go any place alone. She never got to go anyplace special. But Aunt Josephine said, I just want Emma to go. And when they started going, walking down the path to get to the interurban, well, Aunt Josephine said, now Emma, this is a special treat and it's a secret. So don't tell your ma what we did today, okay? Okay, Aunt Josephine. Well, they got there and my mother had a special day. She kind of forgot about don't tell the ma. As soon as she got home, she went running in, Ma! 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 Aunt Josephine took me to town, and Aunt Josephine took me to the store. And in the store, they had girl clothes. And I got this red dress, and it really itched. But it was pretty. Oh, it was so pretty. And I got some white girl socks, and I got some girl shoes. And she had me put them all on. And then we went across the street and we went into this building. And in this building, like, there was hardly anything in this building. There was this thing on legs, great big tall legs. And there was a big screen. And they had me stand by this big screen. And then the man, he told me, don't move, just stand as straight as you can. Don't move, no matter what happens. And then this man, he got behind this kind of spidery legged thing, and he put his head under this cloth, and he had this bulb thing, this squeezy thing in one hand, and he says, don't move, remember, whatever you do, don't move. So I just stood there, I didn't move one bit, and then that man shooted fire at me. Well, I didn't know what was happening, but it sure was exciting. Well, of course, by that time, Grandma figured out that this was the only time that my mother ever had her picture taken, a formal picture, by herself in a town wearing a red wool dress in August to save for her mother's Christmas present. I don't know what happened to that dress. She said she never saw it again, never wore it. My guess is that it went back to the store as soon as they got the picture taken. So as I said, she didn't like the clothes she was wearing, except for that red dress. But you know, it makes me wonder. My mother, I don't remember her ever wearing anything but high heels. She never wore any, you know, tie-up shoes or moccasins or anything. She always wore high heels when I was little. Well, of course she wore them to church and she wore them to shop. But I remember seeing her stand in front of the stove canning peaches and cherries wearing high heels. I remember her scrubbing the floor wearing high heels. I never remembered her wearing anything except that or once in a while being barefoot. She also wore hose. Now, those she didn't wear all the time at the house because this was during World War II and hose were pretty hard to get and pretty expensive. So sometimes she didn't wear that. But every other time she wore those kinds of clothes. And never did she wear any pants. Well, as my mother got older, she had to start school like everybody else, and her three brothers were already in school. And so the first day of school, my mother went to school, and she was wearing those coveralls and a shirt and those shoes and those bumpy socks, and she went to school with her brothers. She went to school for about a week, and then the school teacher called my grandma in. She wanted to talk to her. Well, my grandma went in there, and the school teacher said, now, Mrs. DeSlover, I know things are really tough for all of us around here. None of us have a whole lot of money, but you can't send a girl to school in pants and boys' clothes, you know. They've got to wear skirts when they go to school. She said, almost 6 years old. So you better see if you can find some clothes, better girl clothes. Okay, said my grandma, I'll do that. Well, she went home and she dug out all the flour sacks and all the salt sacks and all the sugar sacks that were many different patterns on it, flowers and pretty trees and made out of cotton. And she held them up to my mother to see which one was the right size. And when she got the right size, she got her scissors out. Now, she wasn't much better at sewing than she was at knitting. So what she did was cut out a circle for the arm, cut out another circle for that. They didn't quite match, but who noticed when you were wearing it. And then a circle for the neck, and then she made it about as long as it should be. And that's what my mother wore to school, were these flower sack dresses. And she wore these flower sack dresses to school whenever it was warm, just as the flower sack dress. But in the winter, she still wore the flannel shirts underneath it when it got too cold. And sometimes she even wore the boys' pants if it was really cold and snowy walking to school. And that was okay as long as she took them off when she got to school and wore her dress. After a while, the dresses got a little bit too short. The flower sacks just weren't big enough. And so my grandpa decided to go to the Woolworth 5 and 10 and get my mom some clothes. Now what he did was in the fall, he'd go and buy her three nice house dresses. And they were pretty big and pretty baggy in the fall. By the time spring came, they were getting a little tighter as my mother grew. But she wore those three dresses every day when she went to school. You know, that might be the reason why I never, ever saw my mother in a house dress. She absolutely refused to go and buy house dresses like all the other women did. She would not do that. What she bought were skirts and jumpers and sweaters and blouses. And that's what she wore, with her high heels and hose, of course. My mother discovered layaway when she got a little bit older. You see, she didn't get to graduate from high school. She got really sick. She had, I believe it was diphtheria and whooping cough and an infection in her eye or nose all at the same time, and spent most of the year out of school. Well, she did get a job after a while. She was helping take care of the younger children. But then after a while, when she was about 16 or 18, she got a job working for the lawyer in town, and who had four or five children. And my mother was the nanny for the children, took care of them. Well, as I said, that's when she discovered layaway. You could buy something really nice, because she always believed quantity was not the important thing. Quality was the important thing. And so she would find a nice skirt or jumper or blouse or something and put it in layaway. And after she had paid on it long enough, she would have this outfit. In fact, the dress that she wore when she married my dad, she had just taken out of layaway. And she had put it in it before she even met him. I remember when my dad was sitting in the living room and my mother was going downtown to get a new winter coat. It was in August sometime, and that was the best time to go and put a coat in layaway was in August. She didn't get one every year, of course, but this was the year to get one. Now, I didn't think my dad paid too much attention to my mother's clothes, but this day he said, "Hey, Toots, could you please get something other than those black and brown and navy blue coats? I know they don't show dirt, but get something with a little pizzazz." "Okay," said my mother. Well, we didn't know what kind of pizzazz he had started. When she got home, she didn't say much about her coat, except that it's got some color. Well, when she got that coat out of layaway, it was fire engine red. It was beautiful. It was red. You could see her coming and going. And that started the lady wearing red. Oh, first there was a red skirt that went with the coat, and then a red jumper, and then some red shoes, and red lipstick, and red fingernail polish. And then, when she got to the age where her red hair started turning kind of gray, she died. Even though she knew only loose women dyed their hair red. But she wasn't going to give up that crowning glory of her red hair. She died when she was about 85, about 15 years ago. And we went up to Michigan to have the funeral. They lived in Indiana. But we knew the funeral had to be in Michigan, because that's where all the stories were. That's where, when you came and all the people came to the funeral home for a night and part of the next day, they'd all come and the room would get full and the stories would start going. Stories about her, stories about her brothers, stories that didn't agree, arguments occasionally about what really happened. that that was the time that was the real funeral. And I was getting kind of tired because it'd been a long day. And I sat down and I started watching the people go up to the casket. So help me, some of those people were tiptoeing up. And they get up there, they peek into the casket. And they smile. And a lot of times I heard somebody say, "She's wearing red." Yep, she had her red hair, her red lipstick, she had her red nails. They didn't know it, but there were red shoes on her feet. Everything in red. The other thing they didn't know is that she had told us before she died, "If you don't bury me in red, I'm going to come back and haunt you." So the lady wore red. Excuse me. Now, this is a family story. Just about all true. Can you think of anything that maybe I had to sort of make up? Anything I had to research?
Anything I wish between her and her aunt when she was getting the dress.
Okay. Oops, I forgot to do this, but I'll come back to you in a second. Not tall enough. Okay. So, missing parts. I wasn't there. My mother didn't remember the exact words, I'm sure. But dialogue. Between Aunt Josephine and my mother, what she told her mom when she got home, that kind of stuff you have to kind of make up. Does it sound reasonable, sensible, logical? Maybe. Does in our family. Maybe you'd have different different dialogue. But that gist of it came down through the years, and that made sense to put in there. Anything else about the story that either was missing or had to be found, or you might like to change if you were going to tell it? Actually, I change it sometimes too. Anything?
Maybe some of your mom's feelings about the feelings.
The feelings. Yeah, I know what she wore when I was growing up, and that's all true. But I also. She would tell us how she felt about her brother wearing her brother's clothes and that. But the exact thing, I don't know for sure. I do know I never saw my grandmother knitting. My mother said, thank goodness. She did crochet, though. Got lots of doilies around their house somewhere. I don't know where I put them. So some of those feelings. How do you get the idea of what her feelings would be? How would you know what to put in there?
Certainly her. Taste for finer clothes and away from the men's clothes.
Okay.
Indicated a disgust, or at least a distance from what she grew up with in the early days.
Yeah. Choices, tastes. All these things with what we see helps us know how somebody might feel. Anything else? Well, sometimes the stories, my mother wrote her memoirs when I was a kid. Well, no, actually, I was growing up. And I love reading them. They stopped when I was born. I guess she got too busy. And three of her brothers also did the same thing. They're not alike. They didn't, even the same stories are not alike. And how they wrote them and what they wrote about were different. But sometimes you can have some idea of fast through other people, other stories that have been told, and you have to decide which ones. I have a friend who was doing writing about her parents, and they came over on a ship. She knew the name of the ship. I don't know the name of the ship. My grandpa came over, but she did. But she didn't know much more than that, and the name of her father, and the fact that he had been a blacksmith. Well, what she did was study blacksmiths, their jobs, the challenges they had. She studied the list of other people who were on the ship. She found some other people on the ship that had written something. And then she kind of put this together and melded and said, well, my father, grandfather, I'm sorry, I never saw, but I have a head picture of him, sort of, and I think he must have been strong. You can't be a weakling, a 90-pound weakling, you know, and be a blacksmith. And she developed this character. Is it a true character? Well, it's a true composite character. She doesn't know if it's really her dad. But it, when you listen to it, it sounds like it could be very real. Especially when she put and some of her feelings in there. There are some universal traits. Universal feelings, universal questions, universal ideas. And when she made her dad, it sounded an awful lot like her. She was kind of a bullheaded lady. She was kind of a strong lady. She was, or is, yeah, she's not dead. You know, it sounded like the kind of character she at least wanted her father to be. She fit in that family very well that way. So that's some of the stuff that you can do with the missing parts. If you're an archaeologist, sometimes you dig up a pot. That pot's got all these wonderful pieces. You become a jigsaw puzzle maker. And you put all these pieces together, and then you discover there's some parts missing. What do? You just put some in. Now, they were showing us in various places where we've been that, you know, if you see something that's all red, and then you see some white parts, that means that those are the ones they made up and put in to fit the design of the bowl or the pot or whatever it is. And so we kind of do that with stories sometimes, is you make up the parts that are logical that you think will fit in. I do have the picture of my mother as a child, and she had said that that's the only dress she remembered as a child. And she was standing there like this. So you can imagine the pictures, the way they would take the pictures, the way photography was done in those days. You can kind of put those white pieces in your picture that match the picture that I had of what she looked like standing there and how proud she was. And maybe that made her proud of her red hair. She never complained about her red hair and freckles. So maybe there was pride in those red hair and freckles.
So I assume like that old photo taking you don't know what actually happened there, but somebody who had never seen a camera before,
right,
or stood for it, or certainly the pictures you see, if mm-hmm. they're having to stay frozen for a minute, that it's going to be kind of different and have to be a real stiff pose.
Right. So. And Aunt Josephine, Aunt Josephine was the youngest of 13 children in my mother's family, and she was very, excuse me, that popped up in here. She was very, very close because being the youngest, there were kids coming up before she got married and had her children. And so she was kind of a favorite. And she was especially the favorite for my mother because she would take my mother places. And not a lot of places, but some places. And so that was very special to her. Unfortunately, sometimes we don't get around to asking the questions we wish you did when you're telling a family story. Oh, if I'd have only asked more questions, I could have not had so many blank pieces in there. Well, let's go back here. We'll come back to this in a minute. I just want to go over that story a little bit while it was still fresh.
Can I ask one more question on your story? Mm-hmm. You had a point where the father prompted her to buy something more colorful.
Yeah, my father, yeah.
Do you know that to have been the case, or were you trying to kind of pivot her taste and kind of punctuate the start of her
colorful? I mostly know it. I remember they were talking about it, and I know she always took the bus down to where she got her clothes downtown, and I know she laid them away in that, and I know that my dad was not liking her dull-colored clothes. But whether that conversation as such ever happened, I don't remember. It's logical the way they operated, to put it that way. Good questions. Those of you, I don't remember who wasn't here. This is my husband. Would you like to see if anybody needs the agenda and these things? Okay. And the other things that we did prior to this. And you may each
well, I'll just pass them out. Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a little look at these things. Anyway, at this point, there's two more there. I don't know if anybody didn't get those. I think it's probably just this gentleman. What's your name?
Chuck.
Chuck, glad to have you here. What did I just give you? Okay.
My language.
These are all cut up.
You've got the types of stories, right? I need to get that out yesterday. And here's the
size. Small thing in square. Mm-hmm.
Okay.
These are a number of independent topics that people might.
Yesterday we did. Oops, I'm sorry. Okay. Thank you. I think she got those yesterday. Didn't you get the display yesterday?
I don't
remember. Oh, good. Yeah, when we come here, they say, well, you might have two people in your class, you might have 30, bring enough for 40. So we get to do a lot of this. And because I had done this someplace else recently and did too many like I always do, your bibliography has the wrong data, and it was Southern Ohio Synod when I did a portion of this at our convention down there this spring. Yesterday we talked about folk and fairy tales, and we started out actually on the first day talking about Bible stories. And we were talking about what a storyteller is. And a storyteller doesn't read a story, at least in front of the audience usually. But they've read lots of stories getting ready. Because they can come from a lot of different places. We talked about who can tell stories. All of us. We all tell stories. We may not call ourselves a storyteller, but we tell things. How to tie your shoe. Excuses for breaking the window when you're with your baseball bat. The story of anything. We tell stories. And hopefully we tell stories to children, grandchildren, neighbors, so that if they want to tell family stories, they'll have them there when the time comes and we're gone. Bible stories, a lot of us have taught Sunday school, adult classes, vacation Bible school. All these kinds of things is another type of story we can tell. And a when and a where that we can tell stories. Of course, the greatest teacher, we all as Christians say it's Jesus. Other people would say it's somebody else, I'm sure. But he used stories, lots and lots of stories. And so who better to follow than the best storyteller? Why do we use stories? Character forming, pass on knowledge, history, necessity. This is some of the stuff we came up with on Monday. I tell stories whenever I have an audience. I was telling stories in the cafeteria or in the dining hall the other day because I told stories at Narnia this week a couple times, and one of the kids was pulled out and had to go someplace with his mother and was very upset. And so they came by the table I was eating, and she says, he wants to know the end of the story.
No.
So we told Dana a story, and she wanted to know the beginning of the story. And so we've had a couple of those times too. One of the wins, I have a friend who teaches storytelling to lawyers. Because what do lawyers do when they sum up a case? They're telling a story and they want you to believe their story. So stories are very believable. I don't know where I put it, but somewhere I put all stories are true, and some of them really happened. You just never know which ones are which sometimes. Where can you tell stories, especially family stories? You can tell at a family reunion, funerals, baptism, wherever people gather, the front porch, teaching values, warnings.
That's when I was a kid.
Weddings. I have a friend who tells a lot of wedding stories. I've never been able to do that for anybody, but she does. She's kind of gotten known as the lady who tells stories at weddings. Someday I'll have to go to one of the weddings and see. One of the best things about storytelling is that you do it face to face. And this dear lady here is a children's librarian who tells and reads stories all the time. And one of the best things are being able to look at that person.
Oh, yeah.
And being able to talk to them.
Getting all the kids' little excited faces.
Oh,
and
yeah.
And having them gasp at the right time.
That's right. Well, I was leaving the dining hall this morning for after breakfast, and this one little girl stops and says, "Oh, come here. She says, "I need your name and address and phone number because I might want to remember you later." And
oh.
I said, "What? My first request for my autograph."
Well,
because kids are like that, you know. So anyway, this is just very, very briefly what we did the first day. The second day, we did family stories. I did a story of, what did I do? Oh, Noah's wife. And Noah's wife was cleaning out the ark and grumbling and groaning about the mess, and said her husband told her that she didn't have to clean the ark, they were never going to use it again, but it smelled terrible. And then we went through, how they got in this mess. And then she had to go away because he was calling her to come out and see the rainbow. And they were going to have other events that they had to be part of. We were talking about first person and third person at that point. And the advantage, any advantages for a first person story? I did this. I saw this. My husband told me to go and get food for all the animals. It smelled terrible. I can't believe that we lived that way for almost a year. But so what's an advantage of having a first person story told?
It's a different empathy, I think, with the storyteller.
I know what she's thinking. Well, again, I wasn't there with Noah's wife. I don't even know her name. But again, I can use things. And that's what's on your bibliography, is some of the stuff. This is not all of it, because I didn't want to ship or bring it all. But on your bibliography, there's Harper's World of the New Testament. There's also one I have at home of the Old Testament. And as you read this, you can put these characters in there. You can see how they might have lived. Now, obviously, I teach English as a second language also, and kids and adults both will often say, "Are you a typical American?" And I said, "There are no typical Americans. We're all different." But there's certain qualities that you'll find in most of us. And so we take those qualities out of some of these things. Here's a cultural dictionary of the Bible. And it has a whole bunch of questions, military impact on life, Jesus and the antinoia, the fortresses, the poor, sickness and healing, drinking and eating, things like that. Here's a daily life in Bible times. Now, again, they may not have been the same. We were in Israel and we were up in Galilee and things were very different than they were in Hebron. But there were similarities too. Here's some guy, Old Testament, healing, or, yeah, these were all Old Testament. So those are some of the ones I brought that I used. You look like you have a question.
Yeah, I was just thinking, you know, with Bible so full of stories, or so I was thinking of like some of them are true and some really happened, but in terms of, as a storyteller, which stories of the Bible do you think are, I guess, the best crafted as stories? You know, in terms of either entertainment or what they're trying to convey, or you know, the practices of storytelling.
Well, I like the ones with people that I get to know, with families. I mean, Bible stories are really family stories. I have one with Dinah telling about her bratty brother Joseph. Well, you can start and end at any place in a way. Sometimes we start with their father and mother, or the father and two mothers that are available for them, and can go down through the brothers, and then you can get into Egypt and all this sort of thing. So, you know, that's a whole panorama of family story. And I love telling that, and I love doing it, because there's so many facts in there. And even if there aren't in there, sometimes, what did that coat of many colors mean? Why were they so angry with Joseph? Why did they decide to sell Joseph as a slave instead of killing him? And what did this mean to the whole family? So I like that one. There's not as much about Miriam, but she danced. She was the brother of Moses and Aaron. As a female, I don't feel comfortable being Moses or Aaron or Joseph, but I feel comfortable being the sister who probably knew something about him, even though I know that the families weren't always living together or The girls weren't really part of a lot of this, but it's still, you can make it logical and believable. Or even the mother of the boy who had the fish and bread, feeding of the 5,000. This summer, one of the stories I told was at Vacation Bible School, and the person in charge says, well, could you be the mother, the proud mother of the boy who gave up his fish and his loaves of bread? That is a very shaky story in my mind as far as what really happened at the feeding of the 5,000. But for this story, I took it strictly verbatim, not verbatim, I didn't memorize it, but I mean, I took it as it was written there. I didn't do any speculation about where the bread came from or where the fish, as many people do. I just told the story. I was doing it to kids up to 8 or 9 years old, and I wasn't about to get into a theological discussion. I just wanted them to think about this proud mother and about sharing. And that's what we did. So I don't know if that answers your question or not.
Yeah, but I think it sounds like those are some of your favorites are the ones that you earlier
right.
in the week kind of chose to illustrate.
Yes.
Like I've heard that somebody did a rendition of the life of Christ from Mary Magdalene's perspective.
Oh, I've heard it, but I've never seen it.
Yeah, no, not read it, but I can imagine a change of perspective there, you know, might be kind of provide an interesting twist
That's
on
true.
The narrative, interesting, you know, in this case, a woman's perspective on what's happening, you know, for the culture, that it might, you know, be able to take the facts of the time and employ a very different device where you can kind of add cultural
right.
filters to the story.
Yeah, I've done the one where the dye, the purple, seller of purple, and then I can get a little bit more into the culture of women and what happens and how unique that was. If you want one that's a different perspective, I don't know if you've ever read this, the Adam and Eve Diaries, or the Diary of Adam and Eve, I forget which way it goes.
Is that the Mark Twain?
Mark Twain. Mm-hmm. It's just fascinating. The first time I ever heard about it, and I love Mark Twain, but I never read these, was here at Holden Village, and there was a couple who the wife was an actress, and the husband was, one of them was an actress, one was a pastor, I forget which is which. And one was Adam, and one was Eve. And the way Mark Twain writes it, like for instance, just very quickly, Adam says, oh, this lady just came into this valley, and this lady just talks and talks and talks, she's always asking questions, she's always talking, I just want to be quiet. I don't know what's wrong with her. I don't know why God put her here in the first place. Now that Eve is sitting there writing in her diary, oh, I just met this man named Adam, and God thinks that we would be good together, but he never talks. You ask him a question, he never answers. I just don't think we're going to get along at all. And it goes on and on and on. I'd love to do that, but I don't do any tandem telling with another person. My husband refuses. And I don't know of any way to meld the two and be both characters. I've been Mary and Martha at the same time by changing my headdress and doing it back and forth, but I don't think I can do Adam and Eve together. So yesterday we did folk and fairy tales, and we talked about how their family stories too many times. The Cinderella stories. And all of the different Cinderella stories there are. A Little Burnt Face, Mafara's Beautiful Daughters, Yosin, Cinderella. There's just all these, but they're family stories. Sometimes the families aren't too good, but they're family stories. And the whole point of this is you can tell these just for the sheer joy of telling to anybody you wish to, or you can use it to start a discussion on something else, whether it's sharing, whether it's how you treat somebody, whether it's, the three little javelinas, the pig that saves everybody is in the adobe house and it's a girl. Now that's a different version than most of us are used to, but you can talk about the relationships there.
What happened to me yesterday, I was a little late coming to class, and I was going to another class, and I walked in here, and you were teaching class. I thought, oh, I'm in the wrong class, but by then I was, you know, in pretty far, and so I had no intention of going to your class. It was such a delight. I mean, it was so, I was so surprised. I thought, I talked for preschool and stuff. I've done stories and stuff. But, you know, I didn't need to do that. But it is such, and how you taught us to as adults, to tell stories. And we can tell to our grandkids, or we can tell to old ladies or something, you know. There's a story.
Thank you. I wish I had that all the
time. No, we can tell our stories or tell stories. We don't have to. This is not, you show us how to do it with, as adult. I mean, you know, it's just a, I was shocked. And the little boy that was sitting
here,
there was a little boy sitting here, and he kept, you know, saying things, and he knew her.
Yeah, he'd been in the Narnia Club, one of the Narnia classes.
Right,
And that's one of the problems, is that people think, first of all, storytelling's only for
children.
Yeah, only kids want to hear stories.
And the younger kids, really.
But adults enjoy hearing stories, too. Adults enjoy telling stories. And they you know, we think of folk and family stories and Bible stories, we do it in lots of places. But even the folk tales, the fairy tales, there's so many uses of them, either, as I said, for pure joy or to go someplace else. And that's where we're going to go in just a minute, because we can't teach all days every day. But I want you to take a look at your paper. Let's see, which one? I'm going to skip part of this that I was going to do, because I want to make sure we get through all these. Five languages of storytelling, how to learn a story, family stories, this set here. The first one says five languages of storytelling. And these five languages of storytelling, what the author was saying was that we can see.
I promise to meet somebody.
Oh, okay. We'll see you some other time. We can see so much when we tell stories. And we can see so much that we can't see when we read a story. Not that I'm against reading stories. Read stories to everybody. But there are certain things you don't get in the reading. One is the gestures. When you think about it, and this author says the gestures carry more of a content than words do. Now think about it. Try to tell somebody how to play an accordion. How do you play an accordion? What do?
Keyboard.
Well, I used to play an accordion, so I
know.
There you go. So you know exactly the motion.
I remember how to do it. That's so much more. I mean, to try to explain, well, first you have to take this, and you got to push the box in, and then you got to pull the box out, and you go like this. This is what you do. How about a whirlpool? You're walking along the creek, and you see a whirlpool. What's it look like? What's the whirlpool look like? It goes around. We need a gesture there. Or we might say, how do you draw a triangle? How do you draw a triangle? How many lines? Well, we can say how many lines. You need three, you know. But how do you put them together? Well, you have to have two of them touching. Well, it's like this. And so the gestures are so important. And you can do all that when you have your vocal, your telling part.
And we used to joke that my dad wouldn't be able to talk if he tied his hands.
That's right. That's what my husband says too. All right, let's just take a minute to do this one. Take a card here, and then when we're done, you're going to, you're going to make this expression on your face, and we're going to see if we can tell what it is. Okay. Oh, here's mine. Okay.
you're scared.
Yeah, scared, fear. Now I could describe fear, but just the expression. Okay, how do you feel?
Angry.
Ah, how do you feel?
Joy, elation.
Relief, relax.
No.
Calm, peace, and
relax. You got a tough one.
A surprise?
Astonished.
Admiration.
Admiration. Some of them are more difficult.
I have another one. I haven't picked up two. See if I do better on this.
Confusion.
Yeah.
Okay.
Doubtful. Uncertain.
Yeah. That's about the same
okay.
thing.
All right.
Concern.
Thinking. Concerned.
Puzzle. Uncertain? Oh, she said uncertain.
No.
Contemplative.
What would they want? I guess in a sense, I kind of it's grief, but
it's what?
Our grief.
Grief.
Okay.
That is difficult because it comes in so many different areas. But some of these things, then, you could practice. Or if you're telling to somebody, you could have them try some of these different things.
Uh-huh.
And see what they come up with. It's not easy.
Well,
some are easier than others.
Grandkids have this out, and then they choose one and see if the rest of us can guess.
There you go. That's what you need.
Charades.
Yeah, it is a little bit like charades, isn't it?
Well, you couldn't talk. Yeah.
When you think about it, when you're a baby, you don't have words. What do you have? Gestures.
Mm-hmm.
Now, you do have the sound. We'll get to that in a minute, but you know, if the baby wants this,
mm-hmm.
you don't throw them away. You give them a hug. You grab them.
Mm-hmm.
You hold them. If the baby, excuse me, if the baby is squirming around and you're holding them, you put them down and let them move. So those are gestures that speak louder than the words they might have used.
Mm-hmm.
Now, when you do have sound, of course, the baby also has screams and they have giggles. Let's think about a few words, how the sounds can change. For instance, the words, I'm not even going to say them. And I'm not putting any punctuation at the end either. Say these three words as somebody. Could be a teenager, could be a divorced wife, could be a loving grandmother, could be a little kid who mother says you gotta say this to Aunt Jose, who nobody likes. So how would you say your words? Those three. She's ready.
I love you.
Who might she be talking to? Don't know, but who might she be?
Grandchild.
Yeah.
What?
A grandchild.
A grandchild. Yes. Oh,
that's
what
it
was. Yeah, usually somebody little, you know, somebody younger.
Uh-huh.
Anybody else? How are you going to say it?
I love you.
Oh, I like
to
that.
A wife.
Yeah, to your wife or your husband. Well, how would you say it?
So many different contexts. Mostly other people.
Oh, do three or four.
Other people saying it that I have kind of loaded takes on. I love you.
Ah, that's
more plain.
Yeah, a little non-committal in there, right? How about that husband or wife that just got a divorce and is meeting the ex-spouse? And they.
I'm not sure they'd say those words. But.
Probably not. But maybe they say something in a context of talking about their past and said, I love you, or I loved you. Yeah. Or, I love you. You're not sure whether that person's anger is gone now? So what's the point of that? When you're reading or telling a story, and of course you do it when you're reading too, the sound of your voice can change the whole story. How about this one? A teenager who just got a present that he doesn't like, and his mother says, "What are you gonna say?" How's he gonna say?
"Thank you."
Yes. Somebody who, well, two people. Somebody says, "Thank you," and what does that person say back?
"Thank you."
"You're welcome."
"You're welcome." Yeah, you're right. Or sometimes they'll say, "Thank you." So we emphasize different words at different times. Or the word O-H. O-H, how do you say that?
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah.
Oh.
Yeah. Or, oh! You know, there's a lot of different ways we can do it. Well, we got to move on. We've got attitude, emotion. You might be showing boredom or excitement. You might be showing whether you are antagonistic towards your audience or your audience towards you. You might have a group of middle school kids. And when you first come in, we have to listen to this storyteller, you know? And you can just see on their faces, and then after a while they get excited and they like the story and they start responding. And so how that is happening, it leads to number four, which is feedback. Because you're going to change your stories, or the way you tell your stories, depending on how people respond to you. So feedback, have to be a little careful. A friend of ours was saying that he was teaching in college, and he had a whole bunch of international students. And after every point, he would say, "Do you understand?" And if they went like this, he'd explain it over and over again until he thought they understood. And if they went like this, he'd move on to the next point. And after a couple weeks, a brave soul finally came and said, "Why do you always explain what we already know? And you just go on if we don't know it?" Well, just so happened in this their culture, this meant no, and this meant yes. So you have to be a little careful with your feedback and what happens. And then we've just got the words themselves. I have found the most difficult ways to tell a story is to a radio audience or somebody you can't see. I sometimes do stories to Voice Corps, which is a radio program for the blind. And usually I have a host or hostess with me, and I can tell to that person and make it, use as my feedback and choice of words, whether that person understands or doesn't understand or is enjoying or not enjoying. But if that person's not there, once in a while they'll just say, "Oh, the technician will be there to take care of it, but you can turn it on and off, you know how to do it." And then I don't have anybody I'm talking to except this blank wall. Mm-hmm. And I just really have to work to get that understood. So that's just a little bit about the five languages of storytelling. Family story documentation. If you're thinking of telling family stories and you don't know what the facts are, you might draw a floor plan of where the story took place. Draw pictures. Draw a picture of that camera that shooted fire at my mother. You might want to draw a picture of the schools or the workplace where the story was happening. My grandmother came to live with us after my grandfather died. On my dad's side, we had a two-bedroom house. My grandmother was crippled. She needed a whole bedroom because she had all of her equipment. And so she got one bedroom. My mother, my father, my brother, and I got the second bedroom. We didn't have to worry about getting cold feet in the winter mornings because we just went from bed to bed to bed to get out of the room. And we were very happy when my dad finished the attic and my brother and I could at least move up to the attic and have a curtain between our rooms. But, you know, having pictures of some of these, either pictures in your head or pictures drawn out or notes made, help you tell stories. Whether it's going to be a family story, I put family story, but it could also be any kind of story you're taking from a book. Find pictures of things that you're talking about a period, or this fairy tale or folk tales talking about a period. and get as many pictures as you can that have nothing to do with the story, but helps you see where those characters are acting. Draw a map of your community and mark the most important things that happen. Or make a timeline. Well, or skip the flowcharts. Some people learn stories by chunks. That's how I feel, basically. And I'll have a 1 and a 2 and a 3 and a 4, and I'll have a chunk here and a chunk here and a chunk here, and I don't memorize anything except maybe some of the, if the three bears are coming, you gotta say, not by the hair of my chinny chin chin. You can't change that, the kids will kill you. But there's other things where it doesn't make any difference which words you use, although after a while you kind of get into a pattern with them. So you can do that. Flow charts, some people do it different ways. I do it my way. Or you can create a timeline for your family. This is my family from the time I was born until now. And these are some of the events that happened. I have down here, I was born in 1941, just before Pearl Harbor. The relationship of Japanese and German people at that time to the people around here. My dad worked in the tool and die business, was never home, worked 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. I went to first grade, but they put me in kindergarten because the bossy neighbor girl brought me to school, and my mother had told her I went to first grade, but I had skipped kindergarten just because I went to Sunday school, they said, and I was already 6 years old. And, all the things that happened in that first day, what my impressions of school. My grandparents, Mrs. Stewart, my sixth grade teacher, who took me to my first Gilbert and Sullivan thing, and my whole family, because she was going to be in it. And nobody in my family ever went to Gilbert and Sullivan. My dad loved it, but we didn't have money for it. And so I was introduced to live theater and what that did. And so all the way along, you just put some of those different things that happen, which make for either potential family stories or go back to those feelings again. How did I feel then? How does the character in the story feel? Maybe same way, maybe different, I don't know. Depends on the period and all that. Another way to do it is put all of your family members and when they were born and see what periods of history you're talking about, and then write some of that history or read some of that history. Well, we are out of time. How to learn a story, I won't give you all these. Just read, 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 listen, listen, listen. Chunks, we already talked about. Main ideas, do you love it? I told you that in the beginning. If you don't like the story, dump it. Don't say, well, I gotta do this. There are some professional stories that are asked to tell this certain story. Most of the time they say, no, it's not my story. I'm going to be comfortable, you wouldn't like it. Don't memorize a story word for word unless there are certain parts you really have to do. But basically, storytellers don't usually memorize word for word. Some do, but not all. Make it your own. Keep the events. Keep the truth in it. But maybe how it happened exactly or what the dialogue was might be a little bit different. Find a way of learning the story that works for you. And we've already talked a little bit about that. I didn't say anything about story mapping. I don't do story mapping where you actually draw things like that, but I chunk. I'm a chunker. Or you can call it writing out the bones. You put the skeleton of the story on and then hang the muscles and meat. Practice, practice, practice. One good place is in bed before you go to sleep, because what we remember is often what we thought of last. Some people tell to themselves out loud, tape to the cat, to the dog, to the mirror. I do a lot of it in my head before I ever hear it out loud. But before I tell it, I better hear it out loud. Some people tape. I don't usually tape. And then how to tell the story. We've talked about most of these already. Change your voice. That goes a lot with the sound. Put expression on your face. You already made expressions with your face. Use gestures. Avoid nervous moves. We don't want anybody going like this all the time.
Oh, yeah.
If you're doing that, ask a friend to watch you. And then look at your audience. I like the W. How many of you took speech? And you were told, at least this is what my speech teacher said, you need to have 5 people in your audience. I have a little problem with 3 of you, but that's okay. Mm-hmm. And you look at this person, if there's somebody back there, this person, somebody down here, somebody up here. And by doing this, you're seeing everybody. And everybody sees you talking directly to them. Stay calm if you forget something or make a mistake. Oh, by the way, Johnny had to remember. Or if you leave something out, you might just say, I need to tell you something. I need to tell you that this happened before the other one. But you don't have to say, oh my goodness, I forgot that part. That won't do any good. It's best to know the first line, have that ready, what you're going to do, and the last line. So you can always say, well, I'm going to get there. As long as I know how I'm going to begin and get them hooked and how I'm going to end and have them remember my story. Which is have a strong, clear theme. Okay, so that's basically what I wanted to do today. Your bibliography lists all books I have here plus ones I don't. All the ones on here are ones that I like and I've used. You might find others that you like and that you use. The Martha Hamilton and Mitch Weiss book is where the types of story comes from, and they have a lot of information about that in there, more than that. If you're teaching young children, Mary Jo Huff's book is fantastic, and she has a bunch of other ones too. She's quite a character. I love her stories and what she does. Mary McDonald's startup book. She's a librarian. She's a librarian, had to leave, and she writes from truth. She knows what she's talking about. She's a delightful lady too. Doug Littman, I don't know as well, but this is more for after you've been telling stories for a while. Donald Davis tells almost entirely family stories, and this is a delightful little book about how to tell stories and how to do family stories. So this was what we were going to do today.
Thank you very
Tomorrow
much.
We're going to talk about using puppets and participation stories and stories that teach us truths that we can talk about later. So in other words, you don't just have to say, when I was a kid, you can say, well, yeah, there's a story about this guy who made this, you know, and tell the story and then talk about, well, what do you think he should have done? Especially if it's one of those when I was a kid stories and you're trying to tell them to do it differently. Mm-hmm. So you can let them tell what this guy should have done differently.